the first order of business?
Approved.
Thank you. All right, this is Tom Stanton, and with me is Adam Paul of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Hello, Adam.
Today is September 23rd at 1:30 Eastern Time, and if we can each go around and say our names, that way the people transcribing will know who we are.
Yeah, I'm John Stumpf, Chairman, President, and CEO of Wells Fargo. That's S-T-U-M-P like Peter, F like Frank.
And I am Jim Strother, S-T-R-O-T-H-E-R, General Counsel and Executive Vice President of Wells Fargo & Company.
Adam.
And that's all from our side.
Okay. I'm Adam Paul. I'm with the research team here at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
So thank you very much. Mr. Stumpf, the first thing we usually like to do is get a sense of your personal development over the years from the time you were in school, your career path that brought you to where you are.
Okay, I'll do that very quickly. I'm one of 11 children on a family farm in central Minnesota. I have an undergraduate and graduate degrees from schools in Minnesota. Started out as a repo guy in the mid-70s, joined the former Wells Northwest in 1982, and as you might recall, Northwest bought Wells Fargo 12 years ago, moved its headquarters, and kept the Wells Fargo name. At the time, I was in Texas. Before that, I had gone from Minnesota to Colorado, and then after Texas, spent another year in Colorado, or 2 years, and made my way to San Francisco 8 years ago. And I've been in staff roles, primarily on credit, but for the most of my career have been in line roles, running geographies, businesses for the company. I was named the CEO 3 years ago, and I was named chairman just this past December.
And president, when did that occur, please?
You know, that happened a year before, that would have happened a year before I became the CEO, as I recall.
Okay. So thank you. As I explained to Mr. Strother this morning, I have been struggling with questions of governance and risk management, and have looked at about eight and a half different companies and the way they dealt with the crisis, the way they were able to succeed or not succeed as they went forward. What was interesting in reviewing supervisory reports about Wells was that the regulators in your case seem to have played a role, and I'd be interested in your assessment. The way it looks, but again, we need to hear it from you and whether it's correct or not, the regulators in the mid-2000s were pushing Wells, saying you've got to improve your risk management, among other things. And over time, as one reads these reports, sort of through 2006, Wells appears to have been coming more and more into a position where the regulators were satisfied. I'm curious, first of all, what happened that gave the regulators concern, and second, sort of how you saw that set of issues playing out.
Tom, this is Jim Strother. I think I'll take that because I was kind of in the middle of it, and when it happened in the early 2000s, and John was more engaged in some other businesses he was running.
Okay.
I think it was around 2004, our bank regulators had some concerns about two things, specifically. How our BSA and anti-money laundering program was structured and run. Their concerns were that it was not robust enough for a company of our size at that time. And the other was with respect to one element of risk management, and that was compliance risk management, and to some extent what was then an emerging set of risks, operating risk management. So the things like business continuity planning, vendor management, information security. I think it's fair to say back then that with respect to other risk management in the company, credit risk, market risk, interest rate risk, liquidity risk management, that the regulators were actually quite satisfied with what we did, but it was those specific areas that were kind of all related in how we did them. So in 2004, 2005, if you've reviewed our files, you know that we had a letter agreement with the OCC and with the Fed to improve our performance in that area. And we, you know, set to work with a project and a compliance committee of the board and so forth, and upgraded some of the approaches that we took to do better management in those areas. But, you know, with respect to the kinds of risks that led to the financial crisis, I think we were always regarded as a strong performer by our regulators.
Okay. If I could add one thing to that, we believe at the company that risk is best managed as close to the customer as possible, with strong oversight from independent bodies within the company. We don't believe our auditors or our examiners or our regulators are responsible to manage good, have good risk, they manage risk for us. They clearly have a role to play, but risk starts and stops with those of us at the company level. So let me give you some examples how that works in practice.
Okay.
We've had commercial real estate activities here for years. If you look at the Wells side of the book, we aren't having many commercial real estate problems now because during the frothy times of 2005, 6, 7, and even early 8, when cap rates went way down and prices became crazy, we said, we're not going to do that. That simply makes no sense. On the consumer side, we were the number one retail mortgage originator for most of the last 10 years. There was a time in the 2004 timeframe, 3 and 4, where new products became quite popular. The option ARM, which is negative amortization, layered risk for subprime borrowers. And there were competitors who were doing that sort of thing. We gave up market share. We ceded market and said, that's fine, we're simply not going to do that. We don't see how that makes sense for customers. So those are things that actually came out of our businesses. In addition to that, our audit team here, our credit review, which we call RARE, risk asset review, are quite independent from the business. In fact, audit actually reports to the board from a functional perspective. And we try to employ as many checks and balances that is practical to allow us to make good business decisions along the way.
Okay, let me, if I may ask and sort of drill down on that. There's a loan officer, and I assume some of their compensation relates to the volume of loans they originate in any given year. Is that a fair statement?
There are some positions within the company, primarily on the mortgage side, where they get paid for their production. That is one of the only places, and in those cases we originate to a Fannie or Freddie shelf registration or their requirements, and we don't let them be involved in the approval process. Where we do have people who are involved in underwriting, we tend not to pay for production. And they're paid, we tend to have more salary, less commission vis-a-vis others. And where they are paid a bonus of sorts, it typically involves a broader suite of things than just production. It would be revenues. If somebody doesn't want to borrow, why make them borrow? We don't want to put a team member in conflict with what's good for our customer. So retention, the quality of the portfolio, and all of these would play a part in that. And as part of our incentive plan, each plan, it's all written down, each plan has a knockout. So in other words, if you fail the audits, risk asset reviews, and so forth, your manager, your team lead, I can, whatever, can exclude you from the bonus or you if those are those things are tripped.
And who up the line would do that? Would that be somebody in the risk function who would have that capacity, or would it be somebody else in the production function, trying to, say, the mortgage department, whatever, that would have that capacity?
Well, it actually starts with the board. So the board actually approves the incentive award. Actually, it's the HRC, the Human Resource Committee of the board, but the board ratifies it. And even if we make our goals, if we made our goals in a way that puts the company at risk or whatever, they can say no award. And then as it filters down throughout the company, I would go to, for my direct reports, let's say the mortgage company, as they did a couple of years ago, got no bonus. No one got a bonus in the mortgage company. Because they didn't make their earnings and they didn't do some other things that they, and I would talk with the chief risk officer, I would talk with other people who work with this team to see what transpired and so forth. So it's a combination of the leadership in the management chain and others who work with that group.
Which year was that the mortgage company did not receive a bonus?
That was 2007, was it, Jim?
It was either 6 or 7.
I can't remember. I can't remember if it was in 7 for 6 production or in 08 for. I think it was paid in March of 07 for 2006 activity.
Thank you.
That's right.
I think that's the year it was. It got no bonus.
So what happens in the mortgage department, say in 2005 when things look pretty good, and somebody comes to a loan officer and says, let me choose a name randomly, Golden West is making a lot of money on pay option ARMs, and they seem to be doing all right, why don't we do that? Where does that conversation go?
Those conversations happen, Tom. That's actually a real life situation. Except for they wouldn't have used Golden West, they would have used WAMU or Countrywide names because they were tend to be much more in our face as a competitor. That discussion happened within the mortgage company, and the mortgage leaders came and talked to Dick about it, talked to me about it, he was reporting to me at the time, talked to our chief credit officer about it, our chief risk people in compliance, and collectively, as a team, we said that's inconsistent with our vision and values. We want to put customers first and help them succeed financially. We didn't see how this product would do that, and we were willing to lose people, and we did lose revenue, and we did lose volume because of that.
Let me understand. Go ahead, please.
Those are hard decisions to make at the time, let me tell you.
I'm sure. Actually, I was going to ask you about that down the road here, but I wanted to ask a couple other things first. Do you have your code? If I go to your website, is there some code that will clarify for me with some nuances the cultural value you're talking about of putting customers first and what it means? I mean, there's this whole theory now, and the Fed has now come out with guidance, thou shalt not overlend. It sounds like you had that concept very early, and it would be interesting for us to be able to see how you articulated it within the corporate culture.
Absolutely. We have something, I think we have now the 10th or 12th printing of our vision and values. Each team member gets one. We talk about those. Each year, our team members sign off on our code of ethics, our code of conduct, and it tells people in very plain language how we operate, how we think. And we have 280,000 people, and to get people all moving in the same direction with the same set of values. And that's why I always worry when people paint our industry with the same brush. The pigment is different, and people think differently. Companies have different values. We talk a lot around here, and we'll get you a copy of that vision and values. It might even be online.
It is on our website. You can find it on our website.
Okay, we took a note, so we'll happily do that. Is there something that you could send us? And Jim, I wonder if I might call you later to ask for some supporting documents concerning the structure, sort of the organizational structure of your risk management function?
I'm sure we could do that. What is it you're looking for there?
Let me articulate what I have seen. And I will tell you guys, because I mean, you clearly seem to have been one of the sort of the companies that took risk management to heart. If you go back to the olden days of banking, the person making the loan, the loan officer, would come to the credit committee and say, "I've got this great deal here," and then the underwriter would look at it. And if in a well-run institution, the CEO would manage the dialogue between those two, and potentially you'd come to a synthesis where you increase the collateral or decrease the term of the loan and come to something better than either the loan officer getting their way blindly or the underwriter getting their way blindly and not doing the deal. And I'm just curious whether you had that tension in your company as you went up the line in terms of making loan sort of credit decisions, and if so, how it was institutionalized.
Well, I can give you a sense. It's run very differently depending on the type of credit at this company. So if we look at any commissioned salesperson, like a mortgage broker, since they have no skin in the game, if you will, or little skin in the game once a deal is closed, we have very robust procedures to make sure what we're getting from the loan officer is factual and accurate. And the decision making is very separate from their input. So in other words, if you're getting paid, but that's about the only area that we have that activity. In other consumer businesses, credit card, home equity loans, unsecured loans, student loans, whatever the case may be, we use a lot of models, artificial intelligence, other decision engines to help make those decisions. The area you're talking about, Tom, we've never used in this company the loan committee of any consequence. We like the serial approval process. We want a banker's name on the deal. What happens in a loan committee system, I have found, we used to do it that way, I used to head up the loan committee. Everybody looked at me and see which way I'm thinking. Everybody would think I'm the smartest guy in the room and all line up behind. And it was not much of a decision-making process. Mm-hmm. The biggest grape of the grapevine usually ran the day. It was not even fight between the head person and who's presenting the credit. So now what we do is, let's say Jim's a loan officer, and let's say Jim finds a loan for $1 million. But Jim's sign-up is only $100,000. Well, Jim's going to sign it, and let's say my sign-off is $500,000. Jim and I talk about, I sign off,
Then we'd go find someone up the line that would have $1 million, and then that person would sign. So you get some real ownership. We want our people invested in those decisions. And I think that's the magic. And we put our credit people, like, for example, we have a commercial loan team right in the District of Columbia, right in D.C. We don't have that. 90% of what they do right there can be approved. We have, like, a chief credit officer of that little team right embedded within that work group. So then when we go out and audit, we audit against, were the proper authorities done? Was the administration of the credit right? Is what the person said the company made actually what they made? And we'll do follow-up to the company. So it's a bit of a different process.
How do you
and
keep...
That's why
go ahead.
So that's why I worry about things like Basel II and all these things where they start to make us separate the credit from the collateral and put numbers and all this stuff. When we start to introduce foreign concepts and foreign folks to our process, we think that's a dangerous path to go down, a trail the coach has not been on before.
Mm-hmm. How do you keep your credit officer independent if they're embedded in the production unit?
Well, that's a great question. So the credit officers in those divisions not only report into that business, they also have a dotted line to the credit side of the house. So our credit people help decide who goes into those businesses. And we review to see, you know, if all of our East Coast commercial divisions are doing well, but one seems to have bad credit, probably not just because, not probably just an accident, it's probably because you have somebody with the wrong ideas or too loose on credit, whatever the case may be. We're always working that angle to keep that creative tension there. The tension about, because you want that creative tension. And you know, we have a saying around the house here that our credit people can say no in 8 different languages, but you still want to come back and hear it. So the most effective these people are the ones that don't make it personal with the law officer, because the officers want to make the deals work, but help improve that relationship so it becomes best for the company, for the banker, and for the customer.
And when you would see, you know, the examples of sort of more risky offices, I mean, was this the kind of case where you were retraining people, or you simply just had to make staffing changes?
Well, in the most cases, what happened is industries would have issues. And I also say that tenure in these people, our average officer in these offices probably has 20 years with this company. Some have 30 years. So, you know, we are a big lender to the gaming industry. And when that industry went down, you know, or had challenges, it would be more around the type of credit. But one thing our company's been willing to do, and this is, I think, the real measure of any company, at what point in time do you not follow the herd? You say, this just does not fit our credit requirements. And I'll give you an example. Because it's public information. General Growth, they own most of the malls, a big mall owner. They came out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa. We knew them for years and years and years. We stopped doing business with them a number of years ago just because it crossed that risk area. We said, too much risk for us. And we can give you many, many examples like that.
Is that an industry decision, or is that a counterparty decision, or is that a type of loan decision?
I would put it in baseball parlance, since my Minnesota Twins are doing so well this year. There are federal rights and our state's rights within how we think about our business from a risk management perspective. Our chief risk officer, with his credit people, set what the warning track looks like. You shall not go beyond this, whatever the case may be. It might be around loan to value, might be the type of business. You might say, we don't want any commercial real estate or any loan over 80% loan to value. We want personal guarantees. Whatever, they set the warning track. Then it's the businesses who are close to the market to decide, are they going to play infield ball this year, or are they going to play in the outfield? How far will they take it? So we're always, you know, recalibrating, turning up or turning down our risk tolerance acceptance based on what we think is happening to certain industries, certain markets. You know, we, like I said, we walked away from commercial real estate 4 years ago, 3 years ago, on the investor side because cap rates got too crazy. You know, so our risk people would say we don't like cap rates less than 8% at 8 times. And the business said, geez, we don't like it less than, you know, 6 times. So, you know, they'll even play closer to the infield because they were closer to the market. They said, this is crazy. So that's those kind of tensions are always going on here. And I call those constructive tensions.
I really wanted to sort of get a bit more information beyond this issue. You talked about not following the herd. I mean, and you talked earlier about, you know, giving up market share. How did you present these strategic decisions to investors and to your board as you were sort of passing on what, you know, a lot of your competitors thought were fantastic opportunities?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. So you think about Wells, we celebrated our 158th birthday on July 13th, and we have a culture around here that is very much about long-term kinds of activities. We're here for the long term. Our investors, Warren Buffett being our largest, only talks about long term. So when fads come and go, we tend to, we're aware of them, but we don't get seduced by them. We stick to our vision and values, stick to what we know. I like to say that we're meat and potatoes. If you want tuna tartare and fennel, you got to go someplace else. We just aren't that kind of people. So and the board understands that. They support that. In fact, they demand that of us to understand what others are doing. And when they see shares being lost, they ask questions, same way we ask questions. And sometimes, you know, we will go in a different direction, like building out stores when everybody else is selling stores. We wanted people to come in our branches when people were trying to get people to go outside and stay with the ATM. Everybody got involved in the national card business, and we said we didn't think that was a very good business. We liked the mortgage business. So there's different things that we've done, but they look like, how'd you guys know what you knew? Well, we didn't know that housing was going to go down 50% in some cases. We didn't know about all this trading and retrading and CDOs and negative this and this that. All we knew is you start with a customer, if you help add value and be relevant for them, you're going to do well over a long period of time. And that's what that's so consistent with what shareholders, our investors want, and it's so consistent with what our board demands of us and what we demand of the board.
Well, let's talk about your customer for a minute taking out a mortgage. What in the mid-2000s, what were your chief economists telling you about housing prices and how they were doing? I mean, does that play into the kind of decision, what's good for my customer?
We do have economists here, and they give us their view, but, you know, when you've been around as long as we have been, and frankly, this is my third big rodeo as far as a downturn goes, you know, I'm skeptical a little bit of the good news as I am the bad news. So I can't tell you that I saw a 30 or 40 or 50% downturn coming. I did not. But what we did know is if we do what we thought was right for customers, tell them what they need, help them succeed financially, for the most part, things will work out. We didn't do everything perfectly. But I'm kind of being redundant here, but it's so much part of our culture to do it that way. And our risk systems and are built as part of that culture. So it's I have meetings every Monday morning with my 12 direct reports. At that meeting are my five business leaders, plus our general counsel, our chief risk officer, HR, and there's we've worked together for 25 years, 30 years in some cases. We know how to disagree without being disagreeable. That's enormously important as you're running a company. Yes, it's on paper, but it's also how you behave.
If we can shift for a minute to a similar topic to the one Adam talked about that would concern shareholders, that's the question of how much capital you would retain. And I gather you had a similarly cautious policy in terms of leverage of the company.
Absolutely. In fact, it's we've always had this view that we want to have a fortified balance sheet and strong capital. And you the difference actually is made during the go-go times. Don't do stupid things. Stick to your guns in the go-go times, because when the times turn tough, then you're going to have the resources at your disposal to make some very good financial decisions for the company. The time while COVID came up, we were probably the only company in the country that could have bought them without any special support from the government.
Mm-hmm.
We use our own money. That merger is going exceedingly well. We are beating the pants off of our financial metrics on that. And most of all, we're not practicing on our customers as we're integrating this. Our online is up. Customers are giving us more of their business. We're actually growing business during this integration period, which is almost unheard of. So you're absolutely right. We always believe in strong capital. And frankly, we've always believed in not only strong capital, but how the capital stack looked. We've always been a big believer in common equity. In fact, we never had preferred stock at our company. We have it now as part of the Wachovia merger. We never had it before. We didn't use trucks. We didn't use these. And how that happened, you go back 3-4 years ago, as earnings were starting to wane, companies were doing financial engineering to help their numbers. So everything's about EPS, and EPS is nothing more than A divided by B equals C.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if A is earnings, and if B is the number of shares, and if you want to get C and A's not growing, you've got to affect the number of shares. So they would buy back common stock and issue hybrids that actually behave more like debt that didn't show up as shares, so you could grow your EPS. A bunch of nonsense.
But the numbers for a given quarter or year might look better than yours. Is that a fair statement?
Who cares? Sure. Who cares?
Well, my question is, and we know...
Buffett doesn't care.
Huh?
Buffett doesn't care. Buffett doesn't care. Caffrey doesn't care. Phil Elliott doesn't care. Our long-term shareholders don't, and our team members don't care.
So you're protected because you have only, and we'll go back to your 10-Ks to pick this up, you have a significant percent of your capital base long-term investors rather than funds or others that might just go in and out.
Yeah, I would say a different way. I would say that the attitude of our people, the attitude of our investors, the attitude of that's supported by our culture is about running this company the long-term benefit of our four constituents, team members, customers, shareholders, and communities. And anytime I'm forced to make a decision that might be expedient in the short term but hurts the long term, it's a very easy decision. You go long term. But with that being said, the reason our short-term results have been, or even our intermediate long-term results have been so good is because when you think about doing things for long term, it also helps the short term. You run the company right, you have 80 different businesses that do things, mortgage. So if you cede mortgage share, you pick up someplace else. And it's not always a perfect match, but most of the companies that I see that got in trouble put the stagecoach before the horses. They thought the reason for their business was to make money. And we like to make money also, but the reason is to serve customers. The result is you make money. But we saw others do things that they had to make the almighty dollar, had to make that quarterly earnings at any cost, and they didn't.
Let me ask about your board. I take it you're saying your board is a part of this culture of focus on long term. Is that a fair statement?
It's a fair statement.
Can you think of any decisions you've made where your board has added value?
Well, yeah. I mean, they add value all the time. We have five committees of the board. Every merger of any size we've done, you know, they've been right there with us, not as a rubber stamp, but asking us the good, hard, tough questions about how does this add to long-term value. When we did have that issue in 2004 with BSA and compliance, they took that very seriously. As Jim mentioned, organized a new committee, actually a committee of the audit committee called the Compliance Committee. They put an enormous amount of time in that with us, held our feet to the fire on that. So there are a series of issues along the way around the type of businesses, the performance of our businesses, that they're interested in. An area today, I'll just give you an example, something that we're talking about is corporate social responsibility. How important stakeholders, some that we didn't maybe appreciate in the past as much as we do today because of the new normal, what's happening in the industry and also the fact that, and the country, and also the fact we've doubled in size. That takes on added importance. They're going to be, they're enormously important in challenging us in that area, as an example. So there's tons of examples.
Okay. Because I want to get academic on you for a second. There's a debate between American academics and European academics about the value of inside directors who work in the company. And in the United States, we tend to prize what we think is independence. That may or may not be, but at least they're not inside managers of the company. In Europe, particularly the United Kingdom, the argument goes, gee, it's great to have a few board members from inside the company because then they understand the company's business. And when I look, and I guess my list right here for the moment just in front of me is from 2007, at your board members, they're all distinguished people, but I look at very few that in fact would understand the complexities of the businesses you're in. And I'm curious sort of your thinking on that set of issues.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. You know, I also sit on some boards, so I'm on the Target board and the Chevron board. And board relationships and board involvement is to me a fascinating area. I don't know there's any one structure that is superior to another one, and I know there are differences between the European continent and how they think, even with respect to the separation of the chairman and CEO roles, and about inside and outside directors. I have found that directors, the real value is how they work as a board and not necessarily how, what their individual skill set might be vis-a-vis our industry. Many of our board members have been on our board for years and years. So they, even though Cynthia Milligan, for example, is not a quote-unquote banker. She was the head of, she was the banking supervisor for the state of Nebraska. She, until recently, headed up the business school there. She heads up our credit committee. She is very knowledgeable about our industry. Nick Moore came out of, he was the partner in charge, managing partner for PwC, Price Waterhouse, heads up our audit committee. Very, very knowledgeable on all accounting aspects, but also our, so I could go on the line, and not only do they have their own area of expertise, as a group, they really, I think, are superb and add enormous value. So, now, while we don't have insiders on the board, other than myself, inside the company, management, if you will, management does attend our meetings. We do have some executive sessions where either the board, outside board's alone, or I'm with the outside board. But most of it involves not only our operating committee, but many of our management committees. So there, and it's a learning experience for our people, and questions are asked. It's a very free-flowing, we don't stand much on protocol. We get to work. So while we don't have the formal part of the ad of management, we have the practical part of the ad.
Okay, I guess what I'm wondering about, and this is hard to ask a CEO, but let me ask it in all bluntness. We have looked at a number of CEO board relationships where the CEO was, if I may say so, overbearing. The CEO,
not CEOs, Tom. You got the wrong crowd.
And then we asked one European regulator about it, and they said, you know, the people that are really good, they are often arrogant. So that was the other half. But but I'm trying to understand how you or your predecessor, who was also, at least somebody with a strong core set of values, how you make sure that you get feedback you need.
Yeah. So CEOs come in different packages and sizes and different decibels of volume. But so the boards, the two boards I'm on, and it helps me understand the CEO relationship with the board and vice versa. In the case of my relationship with the board and how I seek them out, for example, before this call, I can tell you, I had a conversation with one of our directors about an issue where I'm looking for some ideas. So I send emails to the directors between meetings. I have at least a conversation, one or two a week, with one of the committee chairs or with our lead director, who really acts, speaks on behalf of the board when I can't talk to the entire board. And I'm frankly humbled by their experience and the wisdom of this board, and I rely on them for, that's who I report to. I serve at their pleasure, and doesn't mean I'm beholden to them or you know, they expect me to lead this company, but we have shared skin in the game. So mm-hmm. I don't know how that. Whether that makes a person arrogant or whatever, but it works well here. And you know, leading a company today is, these are big, complex jobs. You need all the help you can get. At least that's the way I see it.
Okay. And I guess, as with the corporate culture and the prudent corporate culture you were describing earlier, these are the hardest things to try to figure out how to instill in companies that may not have them.
You got it. I tell you what, remember this, culture eats strategy for breakfast every morning.
Very nice. That will be a quote that goes into our book.
All right.
And given
a lot of people with great strategies in these fields, culture is so important.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Given the emphasis you've put on culture, how, as I understand, you took several members of the Wachovia board on to your board after the merger, correct?
Yes, that's true. There was four, there's three now.
Sure. And so how, since the firm, since so much of it is based on the corporate culture, how did you integrate them into the culture, or what did it, did that experience show you things about the way that your culture operates?
Yes, it did. So and there were, first of all, Wachovia was a very, very fine company in many, many respects. They made some very poor decisions that I thought that if you really analyze it, were not one-off aberrations. There was some weakness. There were some weaknesses in their culture that allowed for some of that. And their directors that came to our company have helped us understand that. Or they'll say something like, "Gee whiz, it's really refreshing to have this kind of conversation that probably wouldn't have happened at the former Wachovia." But at the end of the day, at the customer level, the community level, there's so much common about our cultures. We're so much a Main Street kind of company. I always say I spend more time on Wall Drug and in Wall, South Dakota, than I've been on Wall Street. So the three Wachovia directors that have retained in the board that are still with us are terrific, and they've added wonderful value as we now, integrate across the East to the Wells flag.
Can you talk a little about operational integration? I noticed that your board committee, where I might have expected a risk committee, has a credit committee. Where does operational risk go, and what are your policies and practices with respect to issues like getting an enterprise-wide capacity to manage the firm in a common way, or at least in a mutually reinforcing way?
That's a good question. A lot of the risk around integration and operations is resident within the Audit and Examination Committee, the A&E.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more about function at the board level, because otherwise the risks get, you can't boil the whole ocean. So if we talk about succession, which is a big area. If you look at a lot of the companies that got in trouble, they never had succession in place.
Mm-hmm.
It's huge. How can you be a board and how can you be a good company if you don't have succession in place? Even when, so we do a formal succession plan every year around here. Bottoms up. In fact, we're having our board meeting, the September meeting is in Philadelphia on Tuesday. And that's when I present the annual succession plan to the board. So there'll be I just turned 57. I have to leave by 65, even because that's one of our rules. And but if I, met a bus or had a good lottery ticket and was gone, there's an emergency plan. There is a 1 to 2 year plan. There's a 3 to 5 year plan, and there are names so we can. And that's for throughout the organization. When we talk about integrating the two companies, one of the big challenges is to get everybody on the same operating system. It's so core to knowing your customer. And, some of the issues we're dealing with there are very complex. The board will hear reports on that every time we meet and even in between the meetings. Credit would be another one. So we have a number of different things, but that's how we look at that. Financial risk, we would go to the finance committee of the board.
Yeah, and I'll supplement that. If you looked at the charters for our committees, you would see that we do not have a single risk committee. We've divided the risks up among the committees. And some of them are so complex that we don't know how a single risk committee could really do a competent job of that. So we've got a credit committee that handles credit risk. Our finance committee handles, interest rate, market risk, liquidity risk. Our A&E committee handles operating and compliance risk. And our government, our GNC, our governance committee handles social responsibility and some other things that are related to reputation risk. And then the board as a whole is where it all kind of comes together. But whether we can continue to do that in light of Dodd-Frank or not is a question. Frankly, we think we'll lose something if we have to pretend that a single committee could really understand and oversee all these disparate risks.
But even if we had to do that, we'll still keep the other place. We're not going to lose the ability to run to manage the company from a risk perspective.
So let me understand. I mean, we have studied here at the commission, and of course, all of our work is second or third hand, and reputational risk is totally different from operational risk, totally different from liquidity risk or credit risk.
Correct.
And is that what you mean by saying risk is simply too complex to handle all in one place?
From a reporting to a board, yes. Now, within the company, we have a chief risk officer who has that title and that authority, so that person and that person's team can go without with full support from the board and from me and from Jim to go and do what they need to do to check anything to make sure that someone is helping me understand it. But when you share with the board, it's so hard to do it at one place.
Okay, because that was going to be my next question, whether there shouldn't be...
There is.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
Any sense of how many people work for your chief risk officer?
Well, most people would say too many.
Yeah.
We've got, I don't have his org chart right here, but we think there is something like 5,000 to 6,000 people around here that are involved in risk management and risk mitigation practices in one way or another. It's a flotilla.
So
many of them have dotted line.
Many of them, like you said before, dotted line, but there are a lot of people.
All right, I need to go back to this dotted line idea because it's the direct line person that ultimately will decide whether somebody gets a raise or promotion or whatever. I want to go back to that issue because we've seen a few companies that had trouble with risk management with the embedded risk officer in a line unit. Can you help me a little understand that a little more? How you manage that process and make sure these people, in fact, can have their voices heard?
Yeah, when we use a term dotted and solid, it probably means something different here than a lot of companies. Since we think of, we all read the same vision and value statement, we all believe we're invested in the decisions we make around here. If we're finding that the creative tension becomes too creative, we don't care where the solid, where the dotted is. We go solve for that. We think that's just good leadership and good management. So I've seen other companies and I've met people who come out of other companies, and if you're solid, you have the bully pulpit. If you're dotted, you need to influence. We don't think in those terms. So I would downplay. So the credit people that are in the divisions, they feel as responsible to that, to the credit side of the house, as they do to the
the production side of the house. There's not much loss there.
So if you say when we see creative tension turning a little too creative, is the we in that case somebody up the line reporting to the CRO or the chief risk officer? Or
in the case, in fact, I'm the ultimate arbiter. And if I'll give you an example. Chief risk officer comes to me and says, John, I think that, because we look at our markets as MSAs. I think we have 350 of those in on the consumer side. So maybe Dade County would be one MSA, and maybe Chevy Chase would be another MSA. I don't know, but whatever it is. And 6 months ago, Chief Risk Officer came to me and said, you know, we're seeing improvement in some of these, but I think it's too early to tell. Let's cut the loan to value in these certain lending areas. Again, in baseball parlance, he's setting the warning track. He just pulled it in a little bit. And I said, if that's what you think is right, let me see the information. I said, I don't think the business is going to like this very much, but that's what I want to do. I said, okay. A couple of days later, I said, how'd it go? He said, you're right, they didn't like it very much, but they agreed. I gave them the information, and so that's how that works. Those things happen every day around here. And if they get to a point where business says, no, I think you have it totally wrong, then I get involved, or the head of the business gets involved, or the chief risk officer gets involved, and they solve for those things. I got to tell you, I don't get involved in any of those discussions. We've learned around here how to disagree about being disagreeable, and we all want the best thing. So there's this view that all companies are the same, and somehow that the credit people want to throw everything they can against the wall, and whatever sticks they get paid for, and the credit people are working their tails off to say no. It's just such a different culture around here.
Okay. Having interviewed a number of people at a number of companies, I can only agree with you wholeheartedly. To what extent, in terms of limits, do you practice capital allocation? In other words, looking at the amount of capital that you will allocate to back a certain line of business and ultimately a certain large credit.
This is an area that I find so fascinating, where the companies get involved in these complex capital allocation schemes and ROAs and ROEs, and we think so differently. We think about customers and not about standalone businesses. It does not mean that businesses don't have capital. It does not mean that we don't measure their performance. We measure everything around here. But if a customer is buying 10 products from us, the average consumer buys over 6 with us. Mm-hmm. The average corporate business buys 8 with us. If one business doesn't make a very good return, but it's critical to the overall relationship, if you look at it from purely a capital allocation program, you might not do that business, and you might lose that customer. Today, we're making enormous investments in mobile. And mobile's making no money, but it's critical to consumer patterns and behaviors in the future. In fact, right now. So if you get so singularly focused on capital, returns, risk against that capital, you're going to miss. You're going to know every tree in the forest, but you're going to not know you're in a forest. So this would be a very long conversation if we tell you about how differently we think about some of this.
Let me, if I can, give you a hypothetical from another company. Okay. We talked to somebody, and it turned out they had allocated considerable resources for a warehouse line of credit for some big subprime lenders.
Yeah, we've been out of that. That's been gone here 20 years.
And
that's about the stupidest loan you could make.
I won't even go there, but the company's not done well. But we asked the question, how did you think about this? And the answer was, well, it didn't even get up to the CEO because it was such a small percent of our assets. And then we said, yeah, but what percent of your capital was it? And that was a really different answer.
You got it. You got it. So one thing I do spend a lot of time thinking about is not only about capital, where is our capital employed, and where are those businesses that are not critical to the overall relationship game we play, that provide little in the way of earnings, but are huge in reputation risk issues, and or capital use, or even liquidity use. So, and those businesses we're not interested in. For the most part, we don't have businesses like that, but we're always looking at those things. A great example would be, we never got big in the credit card business. We have credit cards for our own customers. We don't have any interest in offering credit cards to our non-customers. Just don't think that's a good business.
Mm-hmm.
Warehouse lending is a great example of that. You're funding hedge funds, doing proprietary and correlation books and things like that. It doesn't start with a customer. Those are just areas that, you know, but when you use that, again, that brush that says all big guys do all the same stuff, that's where the pigment's not the same.
Do you, in fact, use derivatives to hedge your exposure to certain markets?
Yes, we use derivatives in three areas. I'll give you the three examples. I grew up on a farm. My brother bought my dad's farm. It's got 750 acres. Most of it's in corn and soybeans. My brother Galen puts his crop in the spring of the year. He puts all his money into the ground, and he hedges the sale of that crop at the end of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And while we don't do business with my brother, we do business like that a lot with a lot of different people. End users that need this to hedge the price of gasoline if they're a small airline, to whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
We also, and some of that is for interest rates. Some people borrow fixed rate, or maybe they borrow, we won't make a 30-year fixed rate mortgage on a commercial property, will make them a variable rate, but they might want it fixed, so they'll swap it into a fixed.
Mm-hmm.
We sell that product. Secondly, we have some debt of our own. We borrow some money. We have about $150 billion of debt on our books. We borrow that, sometimes fixed, and we want to swap it into floating. Sometimes you borrow floating, we want to swap it into fixed. The third area is we service 1 in 6 mortgages in America. The average mortgage is $220,000. We get a quarter point for servicing it. We get the money from the borrower, we give it to the person who owns the mortgage. That's average $40 a month. We do 9 million of those. So you take 9 million times $40 times 12 months, and you take that out in the future, and that asset, known as the mortgage servicing right, if interest rates go up, that asset extends. People don't pay off their mortgages. Interest rates go down. That asset pays off very quickly. We hedge that, and we use derivatives to do that. So those are the three areas we use derivatives. But we don't have like a derivative desk or things like that, and make markets and stuff like others would think about.
So you use it in a very targeted way.
Absolutely.
You also just described to us how all these derivatives work, which we don't always get from everyone that we talk to. I mean, how important is it to you that you can do this, that you can describe the kinds of derivatives that you're using to someone who may not be a mathematical expert?
Critically important. And what's missed about the so-called exchanges, now there's good reason for us to know as an industry and for the regulators to know how much of the stuff's going on out there. The hard thing about a derivatives desk or an exchange is part of the derivative, let's say my brother. So if we sell him a contract that says he's going to get $4 a bushel for his corn, we're also taking credit risk. We're underwriting the credit of him. So if he doesn't have a corn crop this year, we got to go to him and get the money. And exchanges don't do that very well. And too many times, sometimes these derivatives are fairly unique contracts that you just can't that they're not just available to be commoditized, if you will.
Sure.
Yes, we're not going to be talking about the virtues or problems of recent legislation, but rather the crisis. But we hear you.
you're so smooth.
I see. I wish I were. All right, let us to the one last area to look at. When did you first realize that there were problems in any of the major markets you serve? For example, the mortgage market?
Well, I would say, I'm going to be repeating now, but let's take the commercial mortgage side first. When Dave Hoyt, who heads up our commercial area, who's been around since, you know, Carl Reichert days and then dirt was invented, said, you know, John, we're going to be shrinking our portfolio because the cap rates, what we're being asked to finance, just makes no sense. These things, they can't cash flow at these kind of prices. So I saw it there, and that was probably the 2000 and let's say 6 area. And on a consumer side, when we started seeing these new products being introduced, and when they were explained to me about the kind of low doc, no doc, stated income, option pay stuff, you knew that dog probably wouldn't hunt forever. So it was probably the 2005 and 6 time frame, depending on the type of business. And certain markets were, the sand states were by far the most overheated, California, Arizona, Nevada. We weren't in Florida at the time. So some of the stuff just did not make sense. And then some of the things that we were told by our group on what Fannie and Freddie were doing, the size of their portfolios. We've been warning anybody who would listen that you just can't have that big a book, taking that kind of risk with that little bit of capital. That was absolutely a disaster way to happen. So those were all, there was probably a confluence probably in the 2005 and 6 range in there. Maybe 4, maybe on the mortgage side, consumer side.
Great. Okay, thank you. That's quite helpful. And so we talked to one company that proceeded when they saw the market starting to change to do what they called de-risking, sort of looking at their balance sheet and figuring out where do we have more exposure than we'd like and starting to change that composition a bit. How did you react when you saw that things were changing here?
Yeah, well, when we saw that, as I mentioned, the commercial real estate, we started to, we weren't participating in that. But to be, you know, just to go back to it, there were no wholesale shifts of strategy, you know, when you put the customer first, you put the customer first. Now, there were cases in home equity when we saw, you know, values had gone up. We started to pull back loan-to-value kinds of things. We started to get much more concerned about and who we would buy from loans on the mortgage side, in the wholesale and correspondent channels, and those things have paid dividends. Today, our servicing book is 92% current, where our competitors is about 88% current. Our foreclosures is about 2% of our portfolio. The average in the industry is about 3.2 or 3%, or 3.1 something. And we're always watching that stuff.
We talked to one major firm that did relatively well, that proceeded around the mid-2000s to reduce their risk to the American subprime mortgage market and mortgage market generically, took a lot of effective defensive steps before a lot of the rest of the market, but somehow overlooked their leveraged loan portfolio. In retrospect, were there areas of risk on your balance sheet where somebody sort of put their hand to their forehead and said, you know, I wish we had gotten that, we should have gotten that?
Yeah, we have one portfolio here. So today we have a portfolio of about $750 billion of loans. On the old Wells side, we were at about, let's say, $400 billion, give or take. We have a $10 billion portfolio of home equity loans that we bought from secondary market. High FICO scores, good borrowers. In hindsight, we should not have done that. But for the most part, we adhere to our credit standards, and I'm very proud of how this company behaved, not only through the tough times, but especially during the good times.
These were loans that you purchased from other originators, or that you yourselves originated?
We purchased from other originators.
Okay, thank you.
Now you'd say, why would you do that? And that's a good question. These are the same originators that we were buying first mortgages from. In many cases, these were piggybacks to help, and we were doing business with these companies. Again, we picked only the highest quality of those customers, but still, that's been a difficult portfolio.
Now, did you try in your customer first and cross-selling approach to match customers, or that was virtually impossible? You simply picked up people of the same class that you expected to be of the same class as your first mortgage portfolio.
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. These were customers who, some cases, had a relationship with Wells, sometimes did not. But since we were involved in the first and the second mortgage, we wanted to sell them other products and services to service them. And that portfolio has proven to be not a good decision by this bank.
Well, if you were to go into it again, I mean, sometimes one buys something and it just doesn't work out, particularly in the turbulent markets we had. Was that something where now, if you were thinking about it, you would say, yeah, we don't want that? Or is it merely, gee, that one didn't work out?
No, it's the former. And you learn on these things. You learn that whatever happens in reg reform on the mortgage side, one of the tenets has to be that whoever originates the mortgage, you have to have an interest in seeing that be a good loan throughout the whole term of the loan. And much of the problem that happened in 2004, 5, 6, and 7 on the mortgage side, in my judgment, was the separation between risk and reward. 70% of all subprime loans were originated by brokers. 71% of all mortgages during that period of time, the subprimes were bought by Freddie and Fannie. You've got to, and the brokers, they'd get paid as soon as somebody's loan closed. They're out of the deal forever. What was their incentive to tell a fib or two?
I don't want to go into solutions only because we're supposed to be doing the autopsy, not proposing solutions. But there is a whole theory out there these days that however much skin you want me to have in the game, I can go out and take a derivative position that effectively allows me to shed that risk. Any sense of how to make it really work?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm any smarter than, I'm not as smart as you, and I don't know that I have an opinion. We have people from our mortgage company who's now spending a lot of time with the Treasury talking about that issue and how do we reform Freddie and Fannie, because we need some way to get this debt into the secondary market. There's simply not enough liquidity on banks and lenders' balance sheets to handle all the debt that's being produced. So we've got to solve for that. We simply have to solve for that.
One of the credit risk management issues that we've not talked about, and I'm interested, it's merely we not talked about it or it isn't there. To what extent do you deal, like with your home equity loans, with counterparty risk management and assessing, is this somebody I want to do business with, and how and to what extent, and putting limits on, and was that useful as you went through the 2000s, particularly in the mortgage market?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We were, you know, we had, for portfolio loans, we were always dialing up and down risk tolerances based on, and we're getting out of businesses or in businesses, you know, and the auto business, we would change based on what we thought risk was, and when things got frothy, we got more conservative because we didn't believe that markets could support whatever was happening. So yeah, that's a very dynamic process around here.
Okay. I've asked all of my questions. Yeah?
Thank you much. You guys have been terrific. I hope it was helpful.
It was. Thank you.
Hey, it was great. Thank you very much. And we'd appreciate, Mr. Strother, if we might follow up with you later if we have questions or need documents or something.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Hey, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Bye.
All right.